Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Yoga improves sleep in people being treated for cancer, by Amanda McMillan. People receiving chemotherapy are often plagued by insomnia at night and excessive drowsiness during the day, but a new study in the journal Cancer suggests that yoga can help. Breast cancer patients in the study who practiced at home at least twice a week reported better sleep quality over time compared to those who practiced less often or not at all. The new research is another piece of evidence, along with now dozens of studies, showing that incorporating a mind-body practice within conventional cancer care can help decrease side effects for patients, says lead author Lorenzo Cohen, director of the Integrative Medicine Program at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. Other studies have also suggested that yoga reduces sleep disturbances and fatigue in cancer patients, Cohen says, but most have not included control groups or long-term follow-up periods. This new study did both. In the study, 227 women undergoing chemotherapy for breast cancer were split into three groups. One group attended four Tibetan yoga sessions, which focused on controlled breathing, visualization, meditation, and postures that can all be done from a seated position over 12 weeks. We did this so that anyone could benefit, even if they had challenges doing a more rigorous style, says Cohen. Another group attended a program that involved simple stretching, and the last group did neither and received only conventional care. The yoga and stretching sessions all lasted between 75 and 90 minutes, and the women were instructed to practice what they'd learned every day at home. Before starting these sessions, the women all completed questionnaires and wore trackers for a week to monitor their sleep. They were retested 1 week after the 12-week study period, and again 3, 6, and 12 months later. When the researchers looked at each group as a whole, they found no significant improvements in any group in sleep disturbance or fatigue levels over time. But there was one short-term improvement in the yoga group. 1 week after their final session, the women who did yoga reported fewer daytime disturbances, like trouble staying awake and lack of enthusiasm to get things done, than those in the other two groups. Long-term benefits for sleep were also apparent in women who said they did yoga at least twice a week at home, in addition to the four instructor-led sessions. Compared to those who practiced less and to those in the other two groups, these women reported fewer daytime disturbances at their three-month follow-up, as well as better sleep quality and sleep efficiency, a measure of time actually spent asleep at 6 months. The benefits were modest but still encouraging, says Cohen. The women only attended four classes over 12 weeks, he says, and may have benefited even more from additional sessions. Cohen also doesn't think that one type of yoga, or even one type of mind-body practice, is necessarily better than others for improving sleep in people who have cancer. Other mindfulness practices like Tai Chi and Qigong have also been shown to be beneficial. All of these practices focus on moving the body, relaxing the mind, and regulating the breath, Cohen says. The best mind-body practice is the one you will do every day, and that's what we saw from this study.
President Trump isn't supporting the Trumpier candidate in this key Senate race. Here's Why, by Mash Jenkins. He's outspoken, with no experience as a lawmaker, a track record of politically incorrect comments that have pundits on the Acela corridor widening their eyes, and a deep belief that America needs to be made great again. Sound familiar? This is Roy Moore, the former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, who was removed from this position not once but twice, first in 2003 for refusing to remove a monument to the Ten Commandments he'd had installed in the state courthouse, and again in 2016 for defying the U.S. Supreme Court over its ruling on gay marriage. Now he's running for Senate, but he'll have to get past another Republican who's backed by President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. On Tuesday, Alabama Republicans will choose their party's candidate for the Senate seat that used to belong to Jeff Sessions, who left it in February to become U.S. Attorney General. Moore is up against Senator Luther Strange, whom controversial former Governor Robert J. Bentley chose to hold Sessions' seat in the interim. Bentley resigned 2 months later following allegations that he used state resources to facilitate an extramarital affair with a staffer. Moore, who by some estimates is leading Strange by 8 points, is the more Trumpy candidate, at least in style. But it's Strange who has President Trump's vocal backing. On Friday, Trump flies to Huntsville, Alabama, to stump for Strange at a campaign event, a rare presidential move in a seemingly low-stakes election. Alabama is so lucky to have a candidate like Big Luther Strange, smart, tough on crime, borders and trade, loves vets and military, Trump tweeted on September 20th. Trump has also noted that Strange has gained mightily thanks to his endorsement. In a recent debate, both Moore and Strange laid claim to Trump's mantle, and neither would be far off from the president on the issues. Moore, an evangelical Christian who believes America's ills result from the country's alleged godlessness, has the support of former Trump senior advisor Stephen Bannon and former Alaska governor turned conservative gadfly Sarah Palin. But the Strange endorsement represents a pragmatic decision by Trump, after heavy lobbying from Republican leaders who view him as less unpredictable and risky than Moore. John Putner, a GOP strategist who chairs the Alabama-based right-wing action group Take Back Our Republic, said Strange fits the state's political tilt. His record is conservative, he tells Time. It could just be a matter of getting to 50 votes. It probably feels like Strange is more reliable on things like health care that are sensitive right now. Moore's primary appeal to Alabama voters is his religious fervor. The state, where until recently school textbooks described evolution as a controversial theory, has one of the biggest faith-based voting blocs in the country, Putner says. It's not like, say, Wyoming, where the conservatism is more libertarian. Most critically, the election will be a barometer of Trump's continuing popularity and influence in a state where nearly two-thirds of voters supported him in 2016, one of the highest concentrations of support in the country. Many conservative voters in Alabama are wary of Strange because of the terms of his appointment earlier this year. They speculate that Bentley chose the former attorney general because it would give Bentley an opportunity to pick a new top prosecutor amidst an investigation into his extramarital affair, a claim that conservative sites like Breitbart, helmed by Stephen Bannon, have embraced. Alabama politicos say that Strange's performance next Tuesday will directly reflect how much pull Trump still has among voters there. The vote comes as Trump is working with Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to work out a deal to allow undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children to remain in the country. Conservative pundits and websites such as the Bannon-run Breitbart have blasted Trump for the discussion, dubbing him Amnesty Don. But one recent poll showed broad support for another deal Trump recently cut with Democrats to fund the government for 90 days. And it's not clear yet that the conservative grassroots is upset about the potential for a deal on Dreamers. He's making things happen, 48-year-old Norman Ross, a Trump supporter from Florida, told Time at a rally supporting the president in Washington, D.C. last weekend. How are you losing your base when your base is growing? Robert Mueller's Russia investigation is moving really fast. Here's why. By Tessa Berenson. It's hard to know what special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation is doing, but it's clear that it's going quickly. Experts on independent investigations, including some who have worked with them in the past, say that the former FBI director is moving on an aggressive timeline as he looks into Russian attempts to influence the 2016 election. They say that could help keep it from getting bogged down or off track, like some past investigations. We don't want it to be spread out, says Solomon Weisenberg, who was second in command in the Whitewater Lewinsky investigation into President Bill Clinton. It's not good for the country if it's spread out for 4 or 5 years. I think to me that's a good sign. It's a sign that Mueller is being sensitive to that problem. That independent counsel investigation of Clinton, for example, lasted for 4 years, and impeachment proceedings extended beyond that. It initially began as a look into Clinton's financial dealings with the Whitewater Property Company, but ended up exposing sordid details of an affair between the president and a White House intern. Mueller's apparent speed in tackling a massive investigation is likely related both to his own personality and the grave importance of what he's trying to figure out, which includes whether members of Trump's campaign colluded with Russia. His reputation is as someone who doesn't mess around, says Katie Herriger, a professor at Wake Forest College and author of a book on federal special prosecutors. But I think if you look at the overarching questions of this investigation, they're pretty serious in terms of the alleged wrongdoing, and I think someone of Mueller's stature and commitment to public service that he's demonstrated would want to know the truth about this fairly quickly. Another more concrete reason Mueller may be working quickly, the simultaneous investigations in Congress. As Mueller's team proceeds with their work nested within, but slightly separate from, the Justice Department, committees in both the House and the Senate are also looking into the Russian matter. As Congress interviews some of the same witnesses that the special counsel's office needs to speak with, it could impede Mueller's ability to get the truth. The more people testify, the more evidence gets trampled on, explains Herriger. Stories get rehearsed, people lawyer up, all those kinds of things. The more investigations are going on, the more possibility there is that testimony gets tainted in some way by the cross-investigation. There's also the possibility that Congress offers immunity to someone, regardless of that person's importance in the special counsel investigation. During the Iran-Contra scandal under President Ronald Reagan, for example, Congress granted immunity to three key witnesses in exchange for their testimony. But as the New York Times reported in 1988, that immunity now jeopardized criminal prosecutions of the three, and the new situation inflicted a near-crippling burden on the independent counsel to try the witnesses. Immunity from the House or the Senate will affect the possibility of Mueller indicting, says Ronald Rotunda, a professor at Chapman University School of Law, who worked on both the Senate Watergate Committee during President Richard Nixon's term and was special counsel to the Whitewater investigation. On the other hand, I think that it's important for us to know what's going on. And while the House and the Senate shouldn't pass out immunity orders like breath mints, if it's useful to give immunity, then that's something that they ought to do. Which provides all the more reason for Mueller to work quickly outside the congressional probes, in case Congress is inclined to offer immunity to anyone he is pursuing. It has been reported, for example, that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, a likely target of Mueller's probe, requested immunity from the Senate Intelligence Committee. The request was denied. The question now is just how fast Mueller is really going and when the public will get answers. It appears that Bob Mueller is entirely serious about this inquiry, that he has assembled a very capable and experienced staff, and that they are proceeding apace, says Richard Benveniste, one of the lead prosecutors on the Watergate Special Prosecution Force. They demanded documents from the White House. They've issued subpoenas to various individuals. They've taken testimony under oath, and I would expect that we will be hearing more in the reasonably short term.
Allow Darren Aronofsky to explain Mother by Eliana Doctorman. Spoilers for the movie Mother ahead. Mother can best be described as a fever dream. At least that's how Darren Aronofsky, of Black Swan and Requiem for a Dream, conceived of it when he poured the script into his computer in one frantic haze. Drawing on stories and symbols from the Bible, Victorian literature, and even the Giving Tree, Mother is an allegory for climate change told from the point of view of Mother Earth herself. Jennifer Lawrence plays a woman who serves as both muse and housewife to a cranky writer, played by Javier Bardem. Two unexpected visitors, played by Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer, disrupt the couple's isolated life in their bucolic home. Tensions escalate, and the wife finds herself in increasingly dire straits. Many critics have speculated that Aronofsky is wrangling with being thrust into the limelight himself. He and Lawrence are dating. Aronofsky, who also directed the film, asserts that the film is a wake-up call to humanity. Time sat down with Aronofsky in New York to dissect the complicated and divisive work. Time. Mother is an allegorical epic that has split critics. Why make this film now? Aronofsky. It started off with me wanting to return to the horror genre after Black Swan. I thought that the home invasion movie would be a good place to start because everyone understands what it means to have a guest who stays too long. At the same time, I thought it would be interesting to talk about another home, not your home, not my home, but our home. Time. You mean the earth. Aronofsky, the mother of us all, the one who gave us all life. I wanted to tell a movie from Mother Nature's point of view and talk about her love and her gifts and the way people ultimately cause her pain. Time. I kept thinking of The Giving Tree while watching, the way that humanity keeps taking and taking from Jennifer Lawrence's character until there is nothing left of her. Was that an influence? Aronofsky. It was. It's such a strange book to be one of the most important children's books in history. It's a really, really tragic book. I can't say it was consciously in my head, but very quickly afterwards I realized I had unconsciously tapped from it. Time. What were some other inspirations? Aronofsky. The Exterminating Angel, this film by the great surrealist Luis Buñuel, where all the guests at a dinner party got locked in the room for some surreal reason. Through it, he was able to make a commentary on society. I was thinking about how to talk about global things in a human way. It's very hard to understand the largest forest fire in history. It's abstract to understand what that actually means. We see images, but don't absorb it. But everyone understands if someone comes over and burns a hole in your carpet with a cigarette. I tried to take global events and reduce them to a human scale. Time. I kept thinking, just leave, but of course she can't. Aronofsky. She is the home. There's the allegory. You lean into it, but she's also in love. She's guilty of a certain amount of insatiability as well, which is she wants love from this man, and she's willing to let herself suffer to a certain point. That's very truthful. I know people like that. Time. Mother shows people worshiping and then literally tearing apart certain characters. Is it a meditation on the consequences of fame? Aronofsky. To be honest, I wasn't thinking about that. I think it was a byproduct of casting Jennifer Lawrence and Javier Bardem and Michelle Pfeiffer, who have dealt with that in their own lives. Time. Where do you draw the line when it comes to depicting violence? Aronofsky. I have a real problem with violence and sexuality being used for no reason. Those are very easy tools to rely on and very dangerous to abuse. I try to be truthful to what violence is. There's nothing glamorous about it. But every newspaper, you read Section A and there are terrible things happening in the world. But we can't fathom it. The power of this movie is taking four huge movie stars and putting those violent images up in your face. It's very intense. There are films that are comfort food. I'm not working in that range. I like to push the edges of where feelings are really felt, of what's expected. Time. Do you see yourself as the Bardem character, as some critics have assumed? Aronofsky. I felt like I was empathizing most with Jen's character, but I can see why they would think that. I make movies. He's a writer. There's clearly a connection about the male ego. But I'm connected to every character. I was the ballerina in Black Swan. I was the wrestler in The Wrestler. I was the math whiz in Pi. Time. The story is told from the perspective of a mother, and the camera stays very close to her. How did you wrangle with how to tell and shoot a story entirely from a female character's point of view as a man? Aronofsky. Look, I think we're all people. I think the beauty of cinema is that you can see a movie about a 6-year-old girl from Iran or an 80-year-old guy from Edinburgh. And if the film is made well, you can completely get their experience. When I was a teenager, I would doodle only men, men's faces and stuff. And then when I got to film school, I thought, I've never done something from a female perspective. I should try it. And, you know, making this movie, I'm collaborating with a woman. I would never say, no, that's not how a woman would do something. I may ask, what's going on? But I allow the actor to do her thing, to show the experience through her own instrument. Time. The movie also draws from biblical stories. Why do you keep returning to religion in your films, as with Noah and Pi? Aronofsky. These are myths that belong to the world. They are some of the oldest stories that we've been telling repeatedly since the beginning of humankind. There's power to them. Time. So you are attracted to the symbolism. Aronofsky. When you think of Icarus, you instantly know what that story means. We never debate whether he actually put on a pair of wings and flew up to the sun. If you were to fight over that, you'd lose the whole point of the story. Through symbols, you can talk about things that are pertinent to people living now. Time. Speaking of which, Mother came out as the U.S. was reeling from two of the worst hurricanes in history. Aronofsky. The worst. Harvey was the worst rainstorm in the history of the United States. A forest fire in British Columbia is the worst fire in the history of Canada. The year 2016 had the hottest summer in the history of the world, and the 10 years before that were the hottest in the history of the world. It's not a coincidence. Time. You sound frustrated. Aronofsky. It's very frustrating. I'm a parent. My grandfather came to America to give me and my sister a better life. I can't give that to my children. But I'm an optimist about the future. I think by descending into the dark, you can reveal the light. I hope the movie inspires people to act. Time. Do you think the film is ultimately optimistic? Aronofsky. I think it's cathartic.
Arianna Huffington, 10 Ways to Actually, Finally Improve Company Culture by Arianna Huffington. Huffington is founder and CEO of Thrive Global. There are endless truisms about the importance of company culture, so many that the idea of a strong culture has become a cliche. We often just nod our heads and move on, but it matters. So how can we put flesh and blood on the idea to make it more than just a nice saying? How can companies embody the connection between culture and the bottom line? Here are 10 ways. 1. End the burnout delusion. Burnout is not the price we must pay for success. Leaders need to realize that taking care of their human capital is just as important as P&L, EBITDA, and quarterly earnings. Living a sustainable life and making sure their employees do too is the best way for a leader to sustain growth. 2. Embrace openness. The more transparent a company's culture, the more likely it is that the inevitable problems can be routinely identified and fixed before a crisis hits. Every time a mistake or failure comes to light and lessons are drawn from whatever went wrong, a company is a step closer to a culture built for growth rather than just maintenance. 3. Avoid the growth above all mindset. The idea of growth as a purpose and end in itself becomes cancerous. It metastasizes into every area of the company, determining the people who are promoted and, increasingly, the people who are hired. Left unchecked, it subsumes all other primary values, including empathy, collaboration, and professionalism. 4. Make the workplace work for women. Far too many workplaces are fueled by a culture of machismo, itself often driven by a growth-above-all mindset and burnout glorification. We talk a lot about gender parity and how there should be more women at the top of every profession, but we're never going to get there if we don't change the day-to-day experience of women at every level. Here are some signs that your workplace is not working for women. Women have to pump milk in the bathroom because you've made room for a ping-pong table, but not for a private corner for new mothers. The only way you have to bond with teams is drunken parties. Leaders tell the company story and try to motivate people using all art of war metaphors. 5. Get rid of brilliant jerks. Too many companies buy into the cult of the top performer, which tolerates otherwise unacceptable behavior. The collateral damage may not become obvious immediately, but it is unmistakable over time, as it determines what behavior is deemed acceptable, at least for the select few. Narrowly defined performance is like short-term growth. It might appear to keep you going forward day by day, but a company will eventually find itself way off course. We need to expand our performance evaluations to include embodying cultural principles like empathy and inclusivity. 6. Use teams to build resilience. It is imperative at a time of accelerated change to create cultures that value building teams. Teams can be always on, but individuals can't. They can offer support and amplify and reinforce incentives. They also build empathy, foster creativity, and strengthen resilience. As you learn from your high school gym teacher, for a team, the total is more than the sum of its parts. 7. Treat culture as the company's immune system. Internally, a healthy company values and celebrates everyone's contributions, which directly impacts retention and recruitment. Externally, an unhealthy culture can quickly lead to multiple problems and crises that can damage a company's reputation, especially in the era of social media. In a culture that has run itself down, our resilience becomes compromised, much like the resilience of the human body does. We become more susceptible to viruses that are part of every company because they're part of human nature. In healthier times, we're collectively able to identify these toxic elements and quickly reject them. 8. Meet the demand for purpose. Millennials expect and demand that the brands they identify with stand for principles beyond profit. At the same time, technology has made it impossible for companies to hide behind a glossy ad campaign, and a half-hearted claim to authenticity will undermine a brand. After all, authenticity is the foundation of trust, which is easily shattered and hard to rebuild. Building trust with consumers is much harder when employees themselves don't feel like they're part of a trusting and authentic culture. 9. Model change at the top. Only leaders mature enough, whatever their age, to find a center of strength and calm in the middle of any challenge can initiate the changes a culture needs, and from that place they can make the best decisions for the company. When employees see their leaders modeling this behavior, it creates a ripple effect, especially if employees who follow suit are celebrated and promoted. And 10, use crisis as an opportunity. Any crisis that happens as a result of overlooked cultural problems is also an opportunity to turbocharge cultural changes that are sometimes harder to implement without a catalyst. Often because of inertia or stakeholders projecting the status quo, a spark is needed to get people to look beyond just what's next on their to-do list. I'm a big believer in the power of catharsis, not just because I'm Greek, a purging process that facilitates renewal. The goal when a crisis hits shouldn't be just to get through it, but instead to come out with a stronger culture than ever before. Anthony Bourdain reveals the most annoying thing you can do at the airport. By Kaylee Rizzo for Travel and Leisure. Television personality, chef, and author Anthony Bourdain spends a lot of his life passing through airports. He also has a lot of strong opinions. Therefore, it only makes sense that he has a few sharp words reserved for the people he encounters while in transit. In an interview last week, Bourdain told Travel and Leisure that his top pet peeve at the airport is people who are not ready for the X-ray machine. "They said, no liquids and gels, motherfucker, you know? Come on," he bemoaned. His irritation also extends to the people who have bangles and jewelry and have dressed up, even though they're going to have to go through a metal detector. For Bourdain, the frustration doesn't stop at the gate. He also called out people who insist on bringing maximum stuff onto the plane and jamming it into the overhead, which takes 10 minutes. But Bourdain admitted that he's unlikely to ever react to or even call out the bad behavior he sees at the airport. "I'm pretty good at just pulling the plug at this point, like a recidivist criminal," Bourdain said. "They say that when people who have served a lot of jail time are arrested, they generally don't resist. They go limp. I'm like that, too. I don't get angry. I don't tap my feet. I don't huff and puff or glare at people." And it's unlikely that Bourdain's travel schedule will slow down anytime soon. A new series of Parts Unknown will premiere on CNN on Sunday, October 1st. This season, Bourdain will visit Singapore, the French Alps, Nigeria, Pittsburgh, Sri Lanka, Puerto Rico, Seattle, and southern Italy, a place Bourdain is considering for retirement despite the dangerous carbs. This article originally appeared on TravelandLeisure.com. Are e-cigs bad for your heart? By Alice Park. Scientists are still trying to determine the health effects of e-cigarettes, and until now, they focus their attention on the addictive properties of nicotine and the potentially cancer-causing agents in the vapors the devices emit. But in a small new study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, researchers document another growing health concern of e-cigs, that they may have negative effects on the heart. Scientists led by Dr. Holly Middlecoff, professor of medicine at University of California, Los Angeles, and her colleagues found that devices that contain nicotine can boost adrenaline levels in the heart, essentially putting the heart under stress, which is a major risk factor for heart attack and stroke. Middlecoff studied 33 healthy people who were not current tobacco or e-cigarette smokers and asked them to come to the lab on 3 different days. At each visit, they smoked a different device, a placebo with no active ingredients, an e-cig with nicotine, or an e-cig without nicotine. While e-cigs do not burn tobacco, most do contain nicotine. For years, doctors believed that nicotine, while addictive, was not the component in cigarettes that posed the biggest health risk. Instead, they thought the tar was more concerning. By comparing nicotine and non-nicotine e-cigs, Middlecoff wanted to determine whether the same was true for nicotine and the heart. She found that only the nicotine e-cigs caused an increase in adrenaline levels, which raises new concerns about the dangers of nicotine. While doctors have been worried about the non-nicotine components of e-cigs because of their link to cancer, nicotine may also be contributing to heart problems. That's especially worrisome if people are turning to e-cigarettes as replacements for tobacco cigarettes. Long-term inhaled nicotine hasn't been studied in terms of heart risk, says Middlecoff. If it leads to high adrenaline levels in the heart, which has been shown to be a risk factor in people both with and without heart disease, then that's a problem. Based on the current results and her previous work, Middlecoff suggests that non-smokers should not start using e-cigarettes because they think they are a safer alternative to tobacco cigarettes. But for current smokers of tobacco cigarettes, the e-cigs might be a slightly better option. Many smokers rely on e-cigs as a way to wean themselves off from smoking. Her earlier imaging studies that looked at inflammation in the body due to smoking found slightly less inflammatory responses to e-cigs than to tobacco cigarettes, she says. Inflammation, which can disrupt unstable plaques in the blood vessels, can contribute to heart attack and heart disease. The way I think about it is that if you currently smoke tobacco cigarettes, switching to e-cigs may be a better choice, at least from the data we have, she says. But if you don't smoke at all, I would strongly advise that you do not start using e-cigarettes because they are not harmless. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.